And speaking of the terrifying tales that Nick will be dealing with tonight at midnight and beyond, this being Halloween, we've got terrifying tales of a different sort that we're talking about tonight with Ewan Grossi, an old friend of ours who is professor of English at DePaul University, and at that institution teaches a course in film noir. How's that for the proper pronunciation?
Very good.
Which means to the very tonal qualities of the black and white photography. But all of that we will develop further as we get underway, playing a lot of scenes from many of the famous film noir, and starting with The Maltese Falcon, going on to Murder, My Sweet, Double Indemnity, and a list of many, many more with Ewan Grossi. And all of that will follow right after the update on this evening's news.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
When they had the earthquake in San Francisco back in 1906, they said that old Mother Nature was up to her old tricks. That's the story that went around, but here's the real lowdown. Put the blame on Maine, boy. Put the blame on Maine.
Behind us, continuing, is a woman who was once classified as the most beautiful woman in the world. Orson Welles thought she was. He married her.
So is the Aga Khan.
The Aga Khan married her after that. That's Rita Hayworth. And it's from the film Gilda, which you classify as film noir.
That's exactly right.
I'm saying that in the French style.
Yeah,
film
a lot of
noir.
People, most would say noir.
Noir or
and
noir.
And it's just two syllables, yeah. Noir, noir. Yeah.
Now imagine we're sitting at a Parisian cafe in around the year 1947 or 48. The guy who coined the phrase is at the table, and somebody says to him, mais qu'est-ce que ça veut dire, film noir? What does that mean, film noir?
And he would say it's a film with a dark mood. That would be Darth Vader's The Dark Side, and it's basically the predator side, the Darwinian jungle survival in an urban setting. And it was a space
in an urban setting is important.
In an urban setting, yeah. And they were made in America. He had seen five films. I can give you the names later on. And they were the first ones because of the war. They had not been delivered to France. And having seen them, he saw them as rather existential and bleak. And he also saw them as extremely dark. They were using the technique of chiaroscuro, or dark shadows, brought by German expressionists, where most of the Austrian and German Jewish directors
migrated. So who's this guy who labeled that film noir?
That was Nino. Let's see.
Young Nino at the cafe.
Yes, right. And basically, he was followed by two others, and Nino Frank was followed in about a year later by two men. Mm-hmm. I'll try to get these done. Yeah. Raymond Bord and Etienne Cometan wrote a book called Panorama of the Film Noir American, and they made it popular. And then the philosophers picked up on it, and film noir was established as a name in France, and it didn't come here until... Oh, probably Schrader wrote a book on it later on.
But it is now what we call a genre, a category.
Probably the most heavily criticized genre. There's people
really
like
all
it.
We have to do is really give a fine, all-inclusive, definitive definition of film noir.
Okay,
and
I can
one
do
way
that.
To do that, of course, is first to point to a number of them. We got a number of them on our list. We're going to be playing scenes from Maltese Falcon, Murder, My Sweet, Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, The Postman Always Rings Twice, Strangers on a Train, Asphalt Jungle. What do all of these have in common?
The first thing is a labyrinth. The city as a vortex of moral depravity. I've got this quotation from the Wall Street Journal from later. The morass, or if you want to call it the pit that they've fallen into, a male protagonist, either an ex-GI or a poor man who can't make it without crime, descends into temptation. There's a witch woman called La Femme Fatale, and she entices and seduces him. He has also got a goody girl. He's got a girlfriend from the neighborhood who goes to church and leads him down the altar to domesticity, and he always picks the witch woman. And then he falls into the pit of crime, and then she either kills him if he's rich or she moves on to the next better rich guy. During this time, the protagonist loses. And by the end of the film, it's the beginning of the film. And he's in the present time saying, whoa, if I'd only known what was going to happen. And he takes you back to his, I'll say it, victimization. And in that scene, he's telling you about the corruption. And the big word for one would be betrayal.
That sounds like a plot I've seen a number of times. But on the other hand, it doesn't describe the plots of some of the films we've got before us tonight. Let's start with this great classic film, The Maltese Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't fit that plot exactly.
No, because we have the detective here. And we have two flows coming in. We have the crime films from Hollywood, Warner Brothers in the 1930s. We also have the detective novel coming out of the Black Mask tradition of Pulp Fiction. And that feeds into Chandler, Hammett, James M. Cain. And those two merge. So it could be a detective or it can also be a criminal.
And The Maltese Falcon is based upon a novel by Raymond Chandler.
By Raymond Chandler.
We're going to hear a famous scene. Describe it. Put it in the proper setting for us.
At the end of the film, Bogart, Humphrey Bogart, is talking to Mary Astor. And as Sam Spade, he's told her she is guilty of a murder and of his own confederate, his own partner, Miles. And he tells her she's going to take the fall, but she says, you love me. It just doesn't make any difference. And he rises above conscience, he rises above love and says, you're going to take the fall. And then she implores him, and he turns cold and hard, and he gives us the rationale for the detective. You should do what's right. When your partner is killed, you got to do something.
So in these film noir, there is somehow some man, one hopes the hero, who represents, in a way, moral agency in a corrupt world.
A moral dilemma, yes.
Yeah. Here's that famous scene.
You've been playing with me. Just pretending you cared to trap me like this. You didn't care at all. You don't love me.
I won't play the sap for you.
Oh, you know it's not like that. You can't say that.
You never played square with me for half an hour at a stretch since I've known you.
You know down deep in your heart that in spite of anything I've done, I love you.
I don't care who loves who. I won't play the sap for you. I won't walk in Thursby's and I don't know how many other footsteps. You killed Miles and you're going over for it.
Surely, Mr. Archer, it wasn't so much to you. It was...
Listen. This won't do any good. You'll never understand me, but I'll try once and then give it up. When a man's partner's killed, he's supposed to do something about it. It doesn't make any difference what you thought of him. He was your partner, and you're supposed to do something about it. And it happens we're in the detective business. Well, when one of your organization gets killed, it's bad business to let the killer get away with it. Bad all around. Bad for every detective everywhere.
You don't expect me to think that these things you're saying are sufficient reason for sending me to this.
Wait till I'm through, then you can talk. I've no earthly reason to think I can trust you, and if I do this and get away with it, you'll have something on me that you can use whenever you want to. Since I've got something on you, I couldn't be sure that you wouldn't put a hole in me someday. All those are on one side. Maybe some of them are unimportant. I won't argue about that. But look at the number of them. What have we got on the other side? All we've got is that maybe you love me, and maybe I love you.
You know whether you love me or not.
Maybe I do. Well, I'll have some rotten nights after I've sent you over, but that'll pass.
That's a great line.
It is wonderful.
I'll have some rotten nights after I've sent you over to prison, but that will pass.
But I will survive.
Yeah. We will survive. We'll do much more of this stuff as we continue. In fact, the very next one, Murder, My Sweet, contains one of the great cliches or one of the great inevitable occurrences in mystery novels of the noir of the dark side, namely getting clubbed and falling into unconsciousness. And we'll talk more about that. And we'll hear Philip Marlowe, played by Dick Powell, get bumped on the head and go into a swoon into the darkness. As we continue after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight is an old friend. Hugh Ingrassi is professor of English at DePaul University, where he teaches over a wide range of literary categories, one of them being film noir. And that's your most popular course, I gather.
It is. I'd say if I could, 100 students would register in one section. Yeah. Grad students, they always fill up.
You show them the movies as well, then?
They watch at home online, and then I do cuttings, usually 30 minutes of the key scenes, and we talk about those.
Now, we're going to work through this list, actually. As I was saying, the little excerpt you've got for Murder, My Sweet has one of those classic moments in at least the noirish detective stories. Somebody's always getting clubbed over the head and being knocked out.
Yeah, in this one, Dick Powell, who had just come out of the Warner Brothers musicals, and this was his first voyage into being a tough guy, is Philip Marlowe, which is Chandler's major detective. He has been commissioned to make a ransom payoff for a jade necklace. He's in a convertible. He's in Hollywood outside. And there is somebody in the back seat who had no guts to go do this. And he has trepidation that he's about to be double-crossed, beat up, and it's exactly what happens.
And it's done in the form of voiceover narration, actually.
Right, and it's extremely dark. All you see is the headlights, and he gets conked right in the middle.
Here it is.
We were watched. I didn't see anything. I felt it in my stomach. I was a toad on a wet rock. A snake was looking at the back of my neck.
There should be some white posts in a minute.
Put your head in.
Path there goes down into the hollow where we're to wait.
Check. Wet post. You sit tight. I'll go down and have a look-see. I caught the blackjack right behind my ear. A black pool opened up at my feet. I dived in. It had no bottom. I felt pretty good, like an amputated leg.
The noirish mystery writers almost were in a constant competition as to who could find the best new metaphor for getting knocked out.
That's exactly right. Conked, blacked out, parachute dive. In one of them, Humphrey Bogart tells the young lady who's dying, yell Geronimo as you pull the ripcord. She's actually dying. They seem to have to get bopped over the head because otherwise they'd solve the case too soon. And they can't get shot because then they'd be dead and not be in the serial.
Now let us come to love. We had love of a sort in the very first scene,
yes.
Maltese Falcon.
Right.
The love in the noirish novels and in the films they make of them is never just pure and simple and innocent, is it?
No, it's pure seduction. And part of the reason is many of the critics, particularly feminists, point out males lost their masculinity when they came back from the war. Their wives had been Rosie the Riveter, had all these jobs, had office jobs, and didn't want to go back to being a housewife. As a result, the authors seem to be macho, patriarchal people who say all the women that want to work, all the people who want to compete with men are femme fatales, and all they really want is to take men down. As a gangster's model, they would play one gangster against another, always carrying a pearl-handled revolver and shoot one of them. And the big notion is they're always making money off of corpses. The other strange thing is that the females who are good always lose in these films. They're trying to bring the guy back to church, bring back to a lunch pail and all that, and they're not going to make it.
We've got two films in the category tonight in which the woman, the femme fatale,
right,
as you call her, persuades the illegitimate lover who's come on the scene to kill her husband.
The inevitable triangle. Yeah, the first one we talked about before is Postman Always Rings Twice. This is James M. Cain. Cain was a real novelist. He wasn't an amateur like Dashiell Hammett, who was simply a detective for Pinkerton, who went on, wrote stories for Blank Mask, and then he wrote a couple of novels. Or like Raymond Chandler, who was an oil executive, supported by his wife, Sissy, and eventually he got a job with Black Mask, and then he wrote novels, but he had an English education. With Cain, in this, we get a real tryst. We get a Greek restaurant owner, we get Cora, his wife, and Frank.
Played here by Lana Turner.
Right, and Lana Turner is by John Garfield, who is this drifter who comes in.
Yeah.
And in this scene, she is seducing him in the movie with a white sarong, and she's telling him it would be easy to kill him. We'd have all this money.
Well, you're jumping ahead on the list, then. I'm telling our friends in the booth, this is number six, and we'll go directly to it. This is really a chilling scene.
It is.
And Lana Turner is the beautiful personification of ultimate evil.
Yes, she is the blonde type.
Yeah, here she is.
What are we going to do?
That's great coming from you, after you've been high-hatting me the way you have.
But what else could I do? Oh, Frank. Frank, if I'd only met you first.
Well?
Frank, do you love me?
Yes.
Do you love me so much that nothing else matters?
Yes.
There's one thing we could do that would fix everything for us.
What? Pray for something to happen to Nick?
Something like that.
Cora.
Well, you suggested it yourself once, didn't you?
I was only joking.
Were you?
Yes, I was.
Well, had you started to think about it a little?
Maybe I said it, but I didn't really mean it.
Well, I say it again now, and I do mean it.
Cora.
Listen to me, Frank. I'm not what you think I am. I want to keep this place and work hard and be something, that's all. You can't do it without love. At least a woman can. I've made a big mistake in my life, and I've got to be this way just once to fix it.
But they hang you for a thing like that.
But not if you do it right, and you're smart, Frank. You'll think of a way. Plenty of men have.
He never did anything to me.
But darling, can't you see how happy you and I would be together here? Without him.
Do you love me, Cora?
That's why you've got to help me. It's because I do love you.
Yes, you do. You couldn't get me to say yes to a thing like this if you didn't.
I imagine when I first saw that as a kid or as an adolescent, I would have stood up in the movie theater and shouted, "Don't do it, Frank. Don't trust her."
Except she's so beautiful. You know, he's
got. But it was Lana Turner at her peak.
She was young still then.
Yeah.
And I think we were talking about the other film, which you were just talking about, The Triangle as well.
Double Indemnity. Yes. We just heard sort of the peak of the affair, and they go off to kill the guy.
Right, they do.
And they come to no good, clearly.
Yeah, it comes off a cliff, a car, and then they double-cross each other.
But here we have the beginning of a similar deadly affair. This is from the film Double Indemnity. Fred McMurray, otherwise a very sweet fellow with his movie persona.
He did not want to take on this role. He thought it would ruin his movie idol hero image.
Maybe it did.
Barbara Stanwyck didn't want to do it because they made her go blonde.
Yeah. Who's the author of the novel?
Double Indemnity, the author of the film is... the scriptwriter is Billy Wilder. And Raymond Chandler did it as well. Wilder grew up in Austria, moved to Berlin, did films, taught Hitchcock.
Oh, yes, famous American
Paris,
director.
Then he went to the United States and started as a film writer. Then he became a director. Now, the book comes from James M. Cain.
I thought so.
And he's a lover.
Same author.
He can write love stories, and he's got this love story.
So here we have a famous flirtation scene of sorts, we might call it. And Barbara Stanwyck is luring him on just a bit, but she hasn't yet revealed she hasn't played her cards yet.
Can I set it up? He's a very hip insurance salesman.
Exactly.
And he deals with murders and all kinds of double indemnities. You get double the money if it's an accidental death. She wants to write a policy on her husband without her husband knowing it, because she plans on bumping him off. That's the only word for it. As a result, he comes in and he gets very taken by her. She's in a bathrobe at the beginning and then a towel. Then she comes down in this felt outfit. And this is called wisecracking, smart talk, one-liners, zingers, and all that sort of stuff. And they're playing a sexual game talking about traffic. What we're really talking about is, if I like you, can we do this together?
And here it is.
You're a smart insurance man, aren't you, Mr. Neff?
Well, I've been at it 11 years.
Doing pretty well?
It's a living.
You handle just automobile insurance or all kinds?
All kinds. Fire, earthquake, theft, public liability, group insurance, industrial stuff, and so on right down the line.
Accident insurance?
Accident insurance? Sure, Mr. Dietrichson. Would you tell me what's engraved on that anklet?
Just my name.
As, for instance?
Phyllis.
Phyllis, huh? I think I like that.
But you're not sure.
I'd have to drive it around the block a couple of times.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it. $8:30 tomorrow evening, ma'am.
That's what I suggested.
Will you be here, too?
I guess so. I usually am.
Same chair, same perfume, same anklet.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
And you wonder which person is hipper in that conversation.
Yeah.
They're both playing the game brilliantly. And this is Billy Wilder. This won the award from the Screenwriters Guild as the best Hollywood script of all time.
Really?
In 2007.
Really? Yeah.
Voted the best script.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because of the wonderful James M. Cain's novel, but partly because Wilder really knew how to crackle it.
Yeah.
This led later to Some Make It Hot, which he has also crackling dialogue.
Very different sort of film.
Yes.
So, again, it's in a setting of gangsters and,
yes,
and trouble and so on.
That's right.
But it's comedic.
That's
this
right.
is not a funny film.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
It's funny in the sense of they're so smart and they're trying to take each
yeah.
other and they fall in love and they realize one's going to shoot the other by the time it's all over.
Yeah. You don't, as I said, you just don't get innocent love in those film noir. I remember one with Edward G. Robinson and Joan Bennett. It isn't on this list tonight, but you know
Scarlet,
what I mean?
Yeah, there's Scarlet Street and The Window.
Scarlet Street, I guess.
Right, and, yeah. the Woman in the Window. He made two of them with her.
Yeah, oh, both of them, yeah.
Yeah, and in one of them...
He's an innocent middle-aged man,
yeah,
and she's the temptress.
Yeah, he wears an apron, he cooks for his wife.
Exactly.
And then he walks down the street, meets her. She's got sort of a pimp. She's that kind of woman, a streetwalker. He falls in love with her. He's a painter. She takes his paintings, makes a fortune with them. He doesn't know this. And at the end, finally, he walks in and there's a mirror scene and her boyfriend's just left and she doesn't want him anymore, Edward G. And he says, but you have to love me. I'm leaving my wife for you. And then he kills her, but you don't see it. You've got a mirror and everything's done by mirror and it's just wonderfully done. But Robinson and Bennett did a wonderful job in those two
Beautiful.
Films.
Beautiful, yeah.
Scarlet Street and Woman in the Window.
We are due for an update on the news. We pause for that and to the WGN newsroom.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And with Hugh and Grossi, I am enjoying tremendously our promenade along the dark streets.
Down these mean streets,
down these
a
mean
man
streets.
Must go.
Which is Chandler's
describing... famous essay on noir.
Yeah.
And hard-boiled fiction.
Exactly. You remember the rest of it?
Basically that morally you're obligated to go because nobody else wants to go.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's a long essay.
And that the central figure, the hero, the tough guy, who's certainly compromised and has had a not fully satisfying or not fully honorable career, but intrinsically he is concerned with functioning like an honorable man, and thus he's carrying the whole moral tone forward in an essentially corrupted world.
Two phrases for him. He is the knight without armor, and he's the saint with a gun.
Yeah.
Sanctified in his holy mission, his errand into the wilderness of the ghetto. And the second thing is basically he carries a gun because he can't survive without it.
But the film we're going to now doesn't have such a character in it. It has a sort of an innocent man.
Right.
But that's as far as his moral attainment goes.
The theme here is that Hollywood corrupts, not... you know, ultimately corrupts, but basically he's
and big
a young,
Hollywood corrupts, absolutely.
Young scriptwriter. He can't make it. He has a car that's going to be repossessed. He drives it into a driveway of a posh mansion. He has to go in to find a phone, and he finds a dead monkey coming out in a casket, and then Eric von Stroheim leads him to the mistress of the house, and it's Gloria Swanson, who's an old star who's now in her dotage. She's about 60, and unbeknownst to him, she needs a writer. And they have this conversation in which she wants to take him to rewrite her, 500 pages of Salome that at 60 she wants to play a 20-year-old, and he's supposed to doctor this script
And
for
you
her.
Know, somebody writing about Hollywood movies did an essay about the cute meat. the way the man and the woman first meet is sometimes cute. And this is a sort of a dark, cute meet.
Yeah, it's very much two prowling animals. He's belittling her, and she is sniffing at him because he's not even a real writer, and she was the biggest actress of her day.
So this is William Holden and Gloria Swanson.
Gloria Swanson.
I've made up my mind we'll bury him in the garden. Any city laws against that?
I wouldn't know.
I don't care anyway. I want the coffin to be white, and I want it specially lined with satin. White. Or deep pink. Maybe red. Bright, flaming red. Let's make it gay. How much will it be? I warn you, don't give me a fancy price just because I'm rich.
Lady, you got the wrong man. I had some trouble with my car, flat tire. I pulled into your garage until I could get a spare. I thought this was an empty house.
It is not. Get out.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry you lost your friend. And I don't think red is the right color. Wait a minute. Haven't I seen you before? I know your face.
Get out, or shall I call my servant?
You're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures. Used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
And it is an involuted film in many ways. She says, get out or I'll call my servant. The servant, the butler character, is played by Eric von Stroheim.
Who's her former husband.
Only later in the film do we learn that he's her former husband.
That's right. Yeah. And in the film, he becomes the keeper of the flame, keeping the goddess up on the altar, and he does anything he can. He's a press agent. He drives her old car, which is a big, beautiful...
And he's also a former director.
Yeah.
Which, indeed... von Stroheim was.
Yes.
As well
and
as an actor.
Von Stroheim, probably the most famous German accented person to come out. Mm-hmm. And he made Greed, which is a 9-hour film, which was cut to 4, which was cut to 2. It's a novel by Frank Norris. And that pretty much ruined him in the profession. And then he turned to acting. He was in Grand Illusion. He's in a lot of European
films. Jean Renoir's great
film.
Yeah,
one of the great actors. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, in which it's a multilingual film. He's French, speaks French and German and English in the
film.
And
it's basically about the amicability of officers of rank and of aristocratic heritage in World War I in a prison camp and the idea of noblesse oblige.
One of the great films of all time.
One of the great ones.
Yeah. We are due for a quick stop for a few commercial messages, and then we will continue. We are wandering down those dark streets and into those dark byways of convoluted and distorted personality, and essentially the contact with the confrontation of evil by a compromised honor, but still honor.
Right, and evil will be defined as the basic betrayal. You can't trust anybody because nobody has any altruism. Everybody is self-absorbed.
You know, a very basic question with regard to films that attain a good deal of popularity. You will recognize this as... a method that once was widely pursued by those who thought critically and wrote critically about movies is that they are dreams that money can buy. If a film is really successful and has heavy box office success, it must somehow be speaking to some unresolved dilemmas or to some deep cultural themes or to some characteristic obsessions of the time and place.
Yes.
So that when... So what films become popular in a given year must tell you something about who the people are who occupy the social space in that year.
Yeah, because you're dreaming into the screen and you're dreaming the American dream, and in film noir it's become nightmare.
Yeah.
And the reason is because we're all betraying each other because we're becoming material.
So these flourished in the post-war years, did they?
It's variously, it could be 1940 or 41 with Detour. You can start it with Casablanca or Maltese Falcon, early 40s, and it supposedly dies about 1957 with an Orson Welles films, which we're going to talk about later.
Disappears as a genre?
In the sense, yes, that we don't have that post-war GI coming back.
Uh-huh.
The crime films are disappearing. The musical's coming in and TV's coming. I think TV killed film noir.
Yeah. And then, of course, films designed for 14-year-olds.
Exactly right. The action trade.
Killed everything else.
And the beach bikini trade, all of those people, right?
We return to Hugh and Grassi. And coming up next, I think, am I right? Next on our list is a Hitchcock film.
That's right.
Strangers on a Train.
That's exactly it.
Good. There are some fascinating undercurrents in this film which need to be discussed. And we shall do so when we return right after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And right back, Ewan Grossi is... You are our Dante guiding us through the...
the Inferno of Noir.
Exactly. The Inferno, the seven layers of the Inferno of Noir. But this is really a fascinating area that we're getting into now. These are all... We're going to be talking about a number of films by Alfred Hitchcock.
Right.
Strangers on a Train is one of them. It also relates to another film of his called Rope.
Right.
Which is not on our list.
And Rope was... It followed a serial killer film that had succeeded. This one did not, and when it flopped, Hitchcock pretty much stayed out of the film industry for a while. It's based upon, Chicagoans are recognized, the Leopold and Loeb thrill killing.
That's the film, Rope.
Right.
Yeah.
And in this particular one, you have two young fraternity people who have a party, and they've got a third member who's sort of the odd man out that they've strangled. And they put him inside a cabinet in which they're serving the food. And one of them is cool as a cucumber. He was the strangler. And the other one is afraid to death. That's Farley Granger. And he's afraid to spill the beans. And then the party transpires. Jimmy Stewart, who is one of Hitchcock's favorite, comes in, their old professor, and he smells a rat, and eventually he's going to out them. It was based upon the crime of two University of Chicago young teenagers who had killed a kid in Hyde Park, right?
Yeah.
And later were tried. And
that's Leopold and Loeb, yes.
Right, which is Clarence Darrow talking for 3 days to get them off. Mm-hmm. It was also later made into another film called Compulsion.
In which Orson Welles plays Clarence Darrow,
right.
I think.
And he gives a long harangue about why you can send them to jail, but you shouldn't kill them because they're too young.
And in that film, and also in Strangers on a Train, which we're going to hear a portion of, but which we've not yet discussed, in both there is an implication of homosexual connection.
Certainly homoerotic and very much. And in the actual case, Leopold and Loeb, they were lovers.
Yeah.
And one asked the other, as in Rope, to kill as proof of your love.
Yeah. So. But in Strangers on a Train, these are two men. Are they both married?
Farley Granger is married. He's got a wife. He wants to leave her. Okay. Hutton is not married. He has a father very rich that he doesn't like. He wants to eliminate the father. And he jokingly says, you know, you could get rid of my father. I could get rid of your wife so you can marry your new girlfriend. He's a tennis pro.
Yeah.
He can't get into the public limelight. And then nobody could find this because there's no motive. I want to point out the author of this book is Patricia Highsmith, who lived in Europe most of her life. She also wrote for people at No Movies, The Talented Mr. Ripley, which Matt Damon acted in, and also a sequel, which is called Ripley's Game of Serial Killing for Money, and that was John Malkovich. So they've gotten some really great actors for this.
Give us the background on this particular scene.
They are on a train. Granger's just come from seeing his wife, not being able to get a divorce. Hutton is disaffected from his father. He hates his father. He wants to inherit his money. And he says, I saw you play. And they have a cigarette lighter, which plays large later on and who identified the killer. And Hutton says, why don't you think about this? You know, if I killed your intended one to get out of the way and you kill mine, they can't trace us. And Farley Granger thinks he's joking. But then later Hutton goes out and actually kills.
You say Hutton, but in the stuff I have in front of me, it says Robert Walker.
Robert Walker. I'm sorry. They look alike. They're both 6'3". My
All
mistake.
Right.
Okay. And in this scene, this is where he broaches the subject in a joking way. And because they're gentlemen, Farley Granger takes it as just a caprice, couldn't be serious, and he pays the price for it.
It's like Lana Turner going directly to the question, kill my husband.
Can I use the phrase? This is an homme fatale. That's H-O-M-M-E, and that's the male version who uses female subterfuge to get somebody to buy into something.
Yeah.
And again, you had that homoerotic thing I talked about before.
Here it is, a central scene in Strangers on a Train.
Want to hear one of my ideas for a perfect murder? You want to hear the busted light socket in the bathroom or the carbon monoxide in the garage?
Neither one. I may be old-fashioned, but I thought murder was against the law.
What is a life for two guys? Some people are better off dead. Like your wife and my father, for instance. Oh, that reminds me of a wonderful idea I had once. I used to put myself to sleep at night, figuring it out. Now, let's say that you'd like to get rid of your wife.
That's a morbid thought.
No. Just suppose. Let's say that you had a very good reason.
Now, let's say.
Now, you'd be afraid to kill her. You know why? You'd get caught. And what would trip you up? The motive. Now, here's my idea.
I'm afraid I haven't got time to listen, Bruce.
Listen, it's so simple, too. Two fellows meet accidentally, like you and me. No connection between them at all. Never saw each other before. Each one has somebody that he'd like to get rid of. So, they swap murders.
Swap murders?
Each fellow does the other fellow's murder. Then there's nothing to connect them. Each one has murdered a total stranger. Like, you do my murder, I do yours.
We're coming into my station.
For example, your wife, my father. Crisscross.
What?
Oh, we do talk the same language, don't we?
Well, sure, Bruno, we talk the same language. Thanks for the lunch.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I thought the lamb chops were a little overdone myself.
Nice meeting you.
Now, you think my theory's okay, Guy? You like it?
Sure, Bruno, sure. They're all okay.
What happens?
Oh, basically, Hutton goes ahead with his side of it, and then he goes up to our friend Farley Granger, and he says,
Walker, Robert Walker.
That's Robert Walker. Hutton was in a film just like it. He says, essentially, I just killed your objective, your obstacle, your wife, so you have to come through for me.
Yeah.
And Granger keeps pushing him away. Granger's engaged to a very beautiful, rich woman, and he can't tell anybody. And he says, if you don't, I'll pin the crime of your wife on you because you're the logical person. So basically, at the very end, there's a big chase back to the scene of the crime. There's a cigarette lighter which identifies somebody, and eventually the good guy wins out and the bad guy gets caught. This is one of the few in which the good triumph.
Interesting you should make that point. Is that the case? In most of them, good does not triumph?
A good film noir should end horribly.
Well,
you
but
can't
look,
have a happy
look at
ending.
The one we started with Bogart and what's her name? Mary Astor.
Right.
Maltese Falcon. Good triumphs there. Mary Astor's
conscience
the
triumphs.
Murderer, and she
conscience
goes,
triumphs, but it's not a happy ending. He doesn't get the
no,
girl.
It's not happy at all.
He doesn't find the Maltese Falcon. The people are going to still be obsessed with looking for the Falcon. And above all, his partner is dead. His partner's wife is putting the moves on him, and Bogart may go to bed with her. So big word for it is dysfunction just rules, so it's not a happy ending.
Well, all these folks are pretty dysfunctional.
Yeah, what you can say is it ends morally. He tries to do the right thing, and that's because it comes out of an author who grew up in England and wants the moral – I'm sorry, Dashiell Hammett, who believed in right, and somehow you should be moral at the end of something.
Another film that you've got on this list, and this is a film I well remember. Also, I think I am right in saying that this was the film in which Marilyn Monroe appeared
for the first time in Hollywood. Yes. She worked with Louis Calhoun. He was her sugar daddy, and she was the sweet candy.
In Asphalt Jungle. Now, this is a crime film. It's about a caper.
Yes.
It's a caper that goes bad.
Criminal thing. And the leader is a guy that just got out of jail. His name is Doc Riedenschneider, played by Sam Jaffe, who was Gunga Din, for anybody who knows Kipling in the film.
Plays it wonderfully. Yeah.
Yes. And
he's a real professional.
Right.
A professional safecracker.
Yes, he is. Yeah. And he's the brains, and he just got out of prison. He doesn't want to go back. He goes to Sterling Hayden, who played a lot of caper films, usually robbing racetracks or something like that, as in another. And he's going to be the brains behind the outfit. And everybody's very
Louis
touchy.
Louis Calhoun is a highly placed political personage
in
the unidentified city, which could very well be Chicago.
Right, and he can afford a mistress called Marilyn Monroe, even though he's much older.
Yeah.
And he's kind of footing all of the expenses for this. He's caving, what's the word for it? Caving into morality. He's making big money.
Yeah.
And the big notion is a criminal is lower class, and they don't touch him, but he can give orders. And in this scene, Doc comes in, talks to his criminal crew that he's going to rob with, and tells him, never trust an honest man. You can only trust a crook.
Now, what makes this film noir?
First, the title, Asphalt Jungle. It's the urban jungle
as
a labyrinth. And asphalt, obviously, is that. Number two, it's the falling out of criminals. But you realize everybody's a criminal. Calhoun is betraying his wife. Later on, he tries to patch it up. She wants to play gin rummy. He wants to have sex with Marilyn. Hayden is betrayed by these crooks who are either not bright enough or not moral enough to be loyal. Jaffe is betrayed by amateurs. And at the end, the heist goes bad and everybody's going to die.
You know, I can't resist telling you. This is a personal memory. When I was a college kid in New York at Brooklyn College, the place we used to go for drinks with our girlfriends or meeting people for 6 o'clock assignations was the lobby of the famous hotel on the Algonquin.
Algonquin Club. All the writers hung out.
In the big room behind. That's where the famous Algonquin Circle met in the 1920s.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about a much later time. But I was there one night waiting for a girl who I was supposed to meet and take to dinner at a very cheap French restaurant. And in that same lobby, because they served drinks in that lobby, it was a very comfortable place to meet, was Louis Calhern.
Awesome.
With a much younger woman. Louis Calhern then was a well-known... He had done film already, and he was also a famous actor on the Broadway stage.
Yes.
And there he was, looking quite elegant, and also pulling out a cigarette. He was one of the great cigarette smokers. I once saw him on the stage do about 5 minutes with a cigarette, just in pantomime, and he held the audience transfixed. And there he was doing essentially the same as charming a young woman who was with him.
And, of course, he was suave, polished.
Yeah.
He had the nice pencil mustache.
And always had double-breasted suits.
Yes, and he was absolutely, the big word for it, but distingué. He just looked wonderful.
So here he is, flying and playing the same role.
Big Hick. The color of his money's all right, but I wish he wasn't so touchy.
Maybe it's a point of honor with him, a gambling debt.
Him, that hooligan, honor? Don't make me laugh.
He's a hooligan, you say?
Yeah, but a small time, a little stick-up cigar stores, gas stations. And every cent goes to the ponies.
One way or another, I'll be all by club ice.
What do you say, Beck? How was your date last night?
The young lady drank too much to be good company. But the evening wasn't a complete loss. She talked more than if she'd been sober.
Yeah? What about?
Your friend, Mr. Emmerich.
Emmerich? Now, look here, Doc.
There's $500,000 at stake. I've got to know where I stand. Emmerich must put up before I can hire a coup.
Him, there's nothing. A dead cinch.
The information she gave me is that he's broke.
Are you crazy? I've seen Mr. Emmerich operate for 20 years. He handles only the biggest cases. He's got 2 houses, 4 cars, a half a dozen servants.
And one blonde.
Doc, whose word you gonna take, mine or some dim-witted dame?
Yours, naturally.
If he's broke, I'm gonna be broke the same way. Lieutenant! Lieutenant!
That guy you saw in my office, he's just passing through.
Shut up. I didn't see anybody. How could I? I wasn't here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Look,
Yeah?
I just came to tell you that you'll have to stand still for a raid.
You mean to have the homie downtown and book me?
It's a short ride.
Look, I thought you were a friend of mine.
Right now, I've got one friend, Dietrich. And Dietrich's going to be out in his ear if he don't make a showing.
All right, but why me? Why pick on me?
Because it's logic. You're the biggest parlor in my precinct. The citizens know it, the newspapers know it, and even I know it. And that Mr. Commissioner knows I know it.
Oh, I just hate to have it happen. I just hate it, that's all.
I'm as sorry as you are.
Look, Lieutenant, I've always given you plenty of cooperation. But you're hitting me at just the wrong time.
All right. Close up, tight. Keep the place dark. Don't answer any phones.
Thanks, Lieutenant. Thanks.
That copper, he recognized me.
How'd you know he's a copper?
I can smell one a block off.
Oh, don't worry about Dietrich. He's on my payroll. Practically a partner. Me and him, we're like that.
Experience has taught me never to trust a policeman. Just when you think one's all right, he turns legit.
We talked about Calhern. Calhern isn't in this scene, but right. That's wonderful
he's
stuff.
He's in the scene right after when the sex goddess shows up.
That's great stuff.
Right. But I love that line. Never trust a cop. You don't know when they'll go legit and turn moral.
And indeed, corrupt police are all over the place in most of these films.
Yeah. In fact, the detective who's moral and smarter than the cops is born in the hard-boiled fiction called Black Mask, magazine Black Mask, the pulp fiction. And basically, they can go anywhere and do everything illegally, whereas the cops have to follow the toe of the line. But most of the cops don't do anything because they're on the take with the crooks.
The honest honest representatives of the law are the private eyes rather than the policemen on the force.
And they're trapped inside a triangle in which the politicians and judges are at the top.
Yeah.
Then you have the criminals on another side of the triangle. And then the other part is the victims. They complete the triangle. The money is transfused into the other two. And the poor detective tries to break that triangle and get these poor...
Do you think Chicago was somehow the inspiration for some of this stuff?
I think Capone has to be for most of it. I think the real inspiration is the detective, Pulp Fiction, and then Chandler and Hammett. But the real inspiration is the jaded, angsty view of German, Jewish, Austrian directors come over here from Hitler and have seen, very simply, the decline of the Western Empire.
You mentioned Billy Wilder. Who else do you mean?
Robert Siodmak, Fritz Lang, who made...
Fritz Lang, yes.
Fritz Lang is an important one. He makes Metropolis, then he comes over here and makes a lot of these films as well. And the whole spate of them were imported by Lang. He would use them as cameramen and so forth, and he'd have them write, then he'd have them direct. And they put on low-budget films because they were recent immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they used black and white. They used special effects, this lighting for scariness, that whole notion, especially shadows. And shadows says nothing is black and white. Everything's gray. So we get all of that. But if I had to say one thing, German expressionism and the angst of a world gone crazy in Europe, and they're transferring the dark vision of Europe that gave us World War II is what's in these films.
The ultimate or most representative film for German expressionism was probably The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yes.
But that's quite different from this kind of thing.
It is, because you get surreal setting. It's almost a stage in a drama. But what you do get is a zombie walking around. You get surreal sets, and you get a murderer that can't be stopped. I thought you were also going to mention Peter Lorre and M.
And M, exactly.
Which is also a German
film. In which
film.
He's a child murderer.
That's right. And he's never caught by the cops. What happens is it makes too hot for the criminals, so the criminals catch him.
He's put on trial by a criminal court.
That's right.
Staffed by criminals.
A kangaroo court of
kangaroo
all crooks.
Court. Wonderful. See.
And he was making business bad for everybody.
Yeah.
And Lorre becomes one of all time. Yeah. He's in Maltese Falcon. He's in all the Sidney Green Street films with our friend Humphrey Bogart.
This is great stuff. And we must pause right now for an update on the news.
This is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And my guest tonight has been on this program many times over the years. Hugh Ingrassi is professor of English at DePaul University, and one of the many strings in his bow, so to speak, is the study of film noir, which we're talking about tonight. A challenge to you is to really make sense out of this very complexly plotted film that we're going to talk about next, and we will hear a scene, of course, namely Vertigo. Interestingly, of course, despite the fact that many of the film noir directors were German emigres, as you say, this, of course, is Hitchcock.
Who is sort of, because he went to Berlin and studied under German directors.
I did not know that.
Yes, he did.
Did
and
he
then
really?
He took it over here. He learned his techniques there.
I see.
And that's how he got his job in Hollywood, because they came first and they told him to come over from England. He made a couple.
Now, the challenge is, while standing on one leg, what's the plot of Vertigo?
Jimmy Stewart is a detective who's lost his nerve in a crime that he couldn't stop, which happened at a height. He now gets dizzy, which is vertigo at heights. Counting on that, we have a husband who wants to kill his wife. He hires an actress, Kim Novak, to impersonate his wife, and he has a portrait painted as if she's his ancestor, this woman called Carlotta. Novak is getting possessed like the devil, but it's Carlotta. She's becoming this other person, and he wants Jimmy Stewart to trail her and find out what happens. Stewart trails her. He meets her. He falls in love with her, and the plot is to get him out to some kind of monastery or convent to go up a church tower. And there, when he develops vertigo, there's going to be a fall, and Kim Novak's going to die, and she dies, and it breaks his heart. Then later, a few weeks later, he sees her on the street and realizes he's been scammed. Doesn't know she's been in on the scam, falls in love with her all over again, buys her clothes and makes her imitate herself as this wife who's been killed accidentally up on this thing. So anyway, Kim Novak scams him. He finds out about it. And when he finds out, he brings her back to the church. And they walk up the stairs to reincarnate the same crime. And it's sort of a gotcha. And he's going to prove that he's not got vertigo and that you did this thing. And I'm going to prove that you did murder. And he's in love with her all this time.
Pretty complicated.
Yes, it is.
What's the scene?
This is the church tower. They're walking up. She doesn't want to go because she knows she's been here before.
Yeah.
And the husband pushed the wife off here, and he wants to see how she's going to react. We're not sure if he's going to push her off because he also hates her for making me be a dupe.
But she does fall to her death.
Let's find out.
All right.
And this is where it happened. And the two of you hid back there and waited for it to clear, and then you sneaked down and drove into town. Is that it? And then you were his girl, huh? Now, what happened to you? What happened to you? Did he ditch you? Oh, and Judy, with all of his wife's money and all that freedom and that power, and he ditched you. What a shame. And he knew it was safe. He knew you couldn't talk. Did he give you anything?
Yes, some money.
And the necklace. Carlotta's necklace. There was where you made your mistake, Judy. You shouldn't keep souvenirs of a killing. You shouldn't have been... You shouldn't have been that sentimental. I loved you so, Matt.
But... I was safe when you found me. There was nothing that you could prove. When I saw you again, I couldn't run away. I loved you so. I walked into danger, let you change me because I loved you and I wanted you. Scotty, please. You love me now. Keep me safe.
Please. It's too late. It's too late. There's no bringing you back.
Please.
God have mercy.
And what's happened is a nun has come up the stairs, and Judy thinks it's the ghost of the wife who the husband killed that she was hired by, and as a result, she jumps back in fright and she dies. So we get poetic justice with the wife died because of her.
Is that the very end of the film?
Yeah, it's the end of the film, and we just see him as a lost soul at the end of the film because he's lost the one woman he loved because she was a killer.
So we've been through a number of these films now, film noir, dark films. Can you still discern a strand of commonality that ties them all together?
Yeah, I think so. I brought a couple of ideas here. One, the strand is usually an overriding voice. It's called voiceover. And you usually get the victim, in this case it would be Jimmy Stewart if you wanted to do it, and he'd say, let me tell you about Judy and Carlotta and how I came to the sorry state. And the notion is rueful, regretful, I made a mistake. I wasn't wise, I wasn't shrewd, and above all, I wasn't a betrayer. I was an honest person, and it's ruined me. So you get that flashback. And the flashback is, would that I could go back and do it again, and I wouldn't be the fool and the victim that I am. That's one. The second is from that, the unhappy ending. And the idea is smoke gets in your eyes. In European parlance, it's angst is normal. What else do you want? It's also Sisyphus. Instead of pushing a rock up the hill, you have to live in the city. To live in the city is a heroic act, and you're not a hero, so you become a victim as well. I think that's basically it. The denouement is always the fall of what would be a protagonist as a hero, but he's a fink, he's a dupe. The big word for it, he's a loser with the big L planted on his head, and everybody takes advantage of him. The notion is don't trust people. I think that's the common thread of all. And I think it's these European directors who couldn't trust their own government, who couldn't trust Hitler, who couldn't trust their own lives, who had lived through the Holocaust. They've got a lot to say.
Even though they're saying it in displaced American scenes.
Yeah, they're projecting. They're transferring their own experience, I think, onto American scenes. And I think also sort of shaking by the shoulders of the American public and saying, when are you going to wise up? Took you a world war to catch on what was going on in Europe, and you did nothing.
It's an excellent and quite persuasive analysis.
Yeah.
Very good. We're going to pause right now for the usual reasons. A few more scenes, but we'll open the phone lines as well. And the lines are now available to any and all who want to join to pose a question, offer a memory or a thought about some of the other great film noir. Got to say that with a French style.
I hope. So
the lines are open, 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. And since we're talking about European style in movies, displaced into America. If you're up very early in Paris or London and want to call us, don't call us, rather, email us if you're listening to us over the Internet. Or if you're on the Pacific Rim, more likely listening to us on the Internet. The email address for such listeners is, of course, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at WGNradio.com. For calls again, 312-591-7200. Right back and shortly on to your contributions after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And at least one more scene before we go to the phones. Though the phone lines are now open, one or two are taken. Others are still available. 312-591-7200. If you want to get in there with a question or a comment or a memory, do so instantly. 312-591-7200. And we're going to a really scary film.
One of the scariest.
And a performance that really stretched the style.
It's a Halloween film. If you want to watch a real one,
really
go back to 1955.
I said it stretched the style of Robert Mitchum, didn't it?
Yeah.
Believe it or not,
this is Charles Laughton's only directorial.
Yes, Charles Laughton.
Charles Laughton was asked to do a film. He chose this from the book. Mm. He did a magnificent job. It has some wonderful actors and actresses. One goes all the way back to the silent era. And Mitchum's in this as a convict who's in prison, and his cellmate has $20,000 or $30,000 stashed away on the family farm. And Mitchum gets out first. He goes to the farm, and he tries to act like a friend. And he doesn't know the money is in this kid's teddy bear. You never can find it. And he just pursues this family. He stalks them. But when he meets them, he acts like a preacher. He's all dressed in black. He has on the four fingers of one hand the letters love and the other hand hate. And he gives a sermon, which he points out how that love and hate are always wrestling. And he squeezes his hands together. And the whole notion is we all come out because hate and love are in a big grappling. And this is the scariest scene because two little kids are watching it and they don't know what to make of this creepy guy.
Who are the other actors?
Gish, I think, one of the Gish sisters.
It's Dorothy Gish.
Yeah.
Or Lillian.
And Shelley Winters is the wife who's trying to protect her two little children.
It's Lillian Gish.
Lillian Gish. Her sister, right?
Yeah.
Very good.
It's a very, truly scary film.
Yeah, and she's been in film at this time about 60 years.
She plays
the grandmother.
She was in Griffith's Birth of a Nation.
That's right. So was her sister.
Yes.
And they lasted up until 1980 almost.
Incredible. Here's that famous scene.
Ah, little lad, you're staring at my fingers. Would you like me to tell you the little story of right hand, left hand? The story of good and evil? H-A-T-E. It was with this left hand that old brother Cain struck the blow that laid his brother low. L-O-V-E. You see these fingers, dear hearts, these fingers has veins that run straight to the soul of man. The right hand, friends, the hand of love. Now watch and I'll show you the story of life. These fingers, dear hearts, is always a warring and a tugging, one against the other. Now watch them. Old brother left hand hates a fighting, and it looks like love's a goner. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. Hot dog loves a winning. Yes, sirree. It's love that won. And old left-hand hate is down for the count.
I never heard it better told. I wish every soul in this community could get the benefit. Oh, you've just got to stay for our picnic Sunday.
No, I must wend my way downriver on the Lord's business.
You ain't leaving in no hurry if we can help it.
John... Mind your manners. Take that look off your face. Act nice.
Why, you don't mean no impudence, do you, boy? Do you, boy? How many's the time poor brother Ben told me about these youngins?
What'd he tell you?
Why, he told me what fine little lambs you and your sister both was.
Is that all?
Why, no, boy. He told me lots and lots of things. Nice things, boy.
Scary.
It really is.
Yeah.
And he is both sinister and smiling at the same time.
Yeah.
And Mitchum had played, what's the word, cowboys. He'd played tough guy heroes, played detectives, but he played good guys. He was always good. And this is the one he said, I am Iago, I am the devil incarnate, and I'm going to scare everybody.
Wasn't there a remake of this thing much later?
No, I don't think so. Basically, we think so because you have so many sinister characters who are stalkers. He follows them in a buckboard. He goes everywhere. And in one scene, Shelley Winters, he follows her, and she drives the buckboard and drowns in this creek. And we just see her hair flowing, and he's laughing.
Poor Shelley is given to drowning. She drowns in
The American Tragedy.
American Tragedy, based on the Dreiser novel.
The Dreiser novel, that's right. Call A Place in the Sun.
Yeah.
With beautiful Elizabeth
Taylor.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Let's go to the phones. You got to get the headset on, and you have to adjust. I should have told you all of this while we were in a break. Below the table is the knob to adjust the volume, and I am doing the same for me, and we will be ready in a moment, I trust. We're having a little bit of difficulty. In fact, I think my mic isn't working right. This will be a good time to pause. Now we have it.
Now we have it.
I was about to say we better take some commercials. But we're in the clear right now, and we go with it. 312-591-7200. Get your calls in right now if you want to be heard, asking a question or sharing a memory or offering an insight into the nature of film noir. 312-591-7200. We go first to Bill. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, a favorite of mine that I think meets most of the criteria for film noir is Out of the Past with Robert Mitchum and Jane Greer. And I was wondering what your guest would comment on that film.
We have similar taste. That's one of our film clips which has been put into a soundbite. We're going to play it, right?
If we have it, I think I'm instructed that we do.
We do?
Yes, we'll play it in a moment.
Mitchum was in all kinds of film noir because the studio made them. And this one, he made with Jean Peters, Greer. If you don't know, some of these ladies were affiliated with Howard Hughes. They were his mistresses, and then they got into films through that. Then they kind of outgrew him. Katharine Hepburn, if you saw the film about him, was one of his mistresses. Mitchum was a tough kid. He worked in oil fields, and he had a great physique and all that. They used him as criminals first. Then they used him here. He's a private detective. As you know, he's tailing Kirk Douglas's mistress, and she's run away with some money. He's supposed to bring her back. He goes down to Mexico. He falls in love with her, and he can't bring her back. Then he realizes she's a femme fatale, and she's playing him too, and he's in trouble with her. She wants him dead. She finally gets him dead, and he's in trouble with Kirk Douglas. The scene we have here is he's talking about how he got into this deep, deep, dark place.
Now, the first thing I want to get off my chest, my name isn't Bailey. It's Markham.
Markham? Jeff Markham?
I should have told you before. I meant to, but I kept putting it off. Because I didn't like any part of it.
Please tell me, Jeff.
Some of it's going to hurt you.
It doesn't matter.
Well, our friend Markham lived in New York. He worked with a sort of stupid, oily gent by the name of Jack Fisher. We called ourselves detectives. That was about 3 years ago, maybe more. Wintertime. One of the coldest days I remember in the town. And we got a call to come over and see a big op.
A what?
An operator. Gambler. He didn't come to see us because he was too high-powered a character. Also because some dame had taken four shots at him with his own .38. Made one of them good. He was taking it in stride, but he had a friend who was a ball of fire.
And if you love the film, it's probably because he's such a hunk. He's a real he-man. And the femme fatale is absolutely wonderful. She seduces him in Mexico. She wears white. She wears all the virginal colors. And the big thing is he's hip, but he's still seduced. He loves her. And he's willing to fight Kirk Douglas, who's much tougher. He's a gang boss. And at the end, he realizes that this woman is no good. The goody girl that you just heard in this previous scene is trying to convert him. He's running in a gas station. He's become a mechanic. He's lost the money. One of the old crooks has come by to tell him, we're on to you. We're going to probably kill you. Go back to see the boss. He goes to see him, but it isn't Kirk Douglas that takes him out. It's his femme fatale. They get in a car, and they're speeding along. And like Barbara Stanwyck and Betty Davis and all the rest, she pulls out a gun and she plugs him in the car.
Is that played by Jane Greer?
Jane Greer, yeah.
Beautiful woman.
Yes. And a lot of these are done in...
It's a wonderfully intricate plot. I mean, you have to follow it very closely.
That's right. So I gave a synopsis and that was it.
You did a good job synopsizing. It was remade at least once later.
Yeah.
I forget with whom, but it wasn't as good the second time.
Usually done with Jane Russell. very simply. And Mitchum is chasing her to Macau. The Macau is a remake of the same thing. There's always the detective following the mall, the gangster's mall.
And falling in love
with her. Yeah, to some beautiful exotic place and falling in love and not being able to complete his job.
Our thanks to the caller.
It's sort of Guinevere and Lancelot and Arthur as well, the triangle there.
Yes, excellent parallel. Let's go quickly to another caller. On 312-591-7200, and Brenda has joined us. Good evening, ma'am.
Hi, Milt. Thank you for taking my call. I just saw a movie a couple weeks ago, which reminded me, I've seen it before and I love it too. It reminds me of The Asphalt Jungle, which you just discussed, of The Killing with the Sterling Hayden.
Exactly
and
right.
And I was wondering, like, it's very similar in the basic plot. And I was wondering which came first and if you have any other comments about it.
The Asphalt Jungle came first. I've got a list. I'll look it up again. The one you're talking about is the racetrack robbery, am I correct?
Correct.
And Sterling Hayden is the gangster leader. They're going to go in and get these duffel bags and fill it with money, and then they're going to screw up in their escape. And basically, I'll check it, but I'm pretty sure the Asphalt Jungle, I've got a list here, and I'll look up the dates in just a moment. I say that because Sterling Hayden was small in the Asphalt Jungle, and The Killing was, he was the lead role, and therefore he succeeded the other
one.
But I'll give you the dates in just a moment. I'll look it up.
Sterling Hayden, if I remember—no, I had a memory that is incorrect. It just occurs to me. I was thinking of the wonderful film that was made from the Hemingway story called—
The Killers.
The Killers.
Yeah, that's Burt Lancaster.
But that's Burt Lancaster, who's lying there as the Swede waiting to be killed by
the boxer because he didn't throw the fight,
exactly.
And the gangs are after him, right?
Yeah.
That was probably the most famous short story. It's set in Joliet. That's where the killers show up at the cafe.
Didn't realize that.
And then they drive into the motel— And the kid from the cafe where they are waiting tells the Swede they're out to kill you. And he says, so what? And he just sits there and waits for them to come and knock him off. And then it flashes back to how he got in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yes. What beautiful actress in it?
Ava Gardner.
It's Ava Gardner, exactly.
When she was married to Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. We're about to pause for the usual reasons. And that is to say for newscast, which comes at the half hour. And then we'll be directly back to the calls. Some room available on the board again. If you've been trying to reach us, make another quick call at 312-591-7200. Now to the newsroom.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Back to the next caller in just a moment. But let me read you, Hugh, an email here from Frank. He says, do you ever think film noir movies will make a comeback? If so, what director do you think could revive this type of film? By the way, I had Professor Ingrassi for an American literature class at DePaul back in the mid-1980s. Good to hear that he still teaches you what he enjoys.
It's a really nice setup question. Film noir never died. It went, in hibernation for a few years.
Yeah.
Then it became color, technicolor. And it became Roger Ebert's meal ticket. He wrote Chinatown, and he published it as a review, and off that year he got the Pulitzer, so it made him.
Wait, who wrote Chinatown?
He wrote the review on Chinatown.
It was for his review.
It made
that
his
he got
reputation.
The Pulitzer.
Yeah. And Chinatown is the beginning of neo-noir, which is technicolor noir.
Yeah, I see.
The same kinds of plots and remakes. For instance, when you look at Double Indemnity, that becomes Body Heat.
Yeah.
And it's made by a newer director. Several of these are remakes. Bonnie and Clyde was a return to film noir with the bloodbath at the end. So we have neo-noir. You recognize it. The Coen brothers have made neo-noir. They're the people who are making it now. Tarantino is making film noir.
Fargo is an incredible film.
Fargo, that's exactly right.
Is that film noir or was it worse?
It's film noir, except it's a bloodbath, which you've got.
Yeah.
There's, because of TV and video games and blood all over the place, you have to have blood. So you have that chopper where they chop
But there
up
you
bodies.
Have Mad Men, absolute Mad Men.
It's okay to do
In Fargo.
That. Yes, you can, simply because paranoia is part of film noir. And paranoia here is murderous rage, and they just do it. They're kind of excusable because the man who hires the hit to try to kidnap his wife is such a putz, he can't solve his problems. And then the killers just want the money, and as a result, they kill without orders, and then he's left up to dry. His father-in-law won't give the ransom, and they're all totally... But the Coen brothers, Tarantino, You get all kinds of film noir right now. The ones I teach, for instance, Blade Runner.
My feeling is it's noirer, if one could say that.
It's
noirer. Even more noir.
It's neo-noir.
Yeah, which neo-noir.
Which is revisiting it, but with Technicolor. And they didn't think, Paul Schrader said, you put it in color, it's not sleazy enough. You lose the shadows, but the scripts are darker.
Yeah. Back to the phones. 312-591-7200. Josh is next. Good evening, sir.
Hi, I had Mr. Ingrassi as a professor for American authors, actually, and Saul Bellow and William Faulkner are now my favorite authors. Because
what did you do with you? Did you tell all your former students
to listen? I
guess
so. I don't know how they found out.
What's that?
How did you find out I was on?
I happened to listen. I love WGN, and I recognize your voice, actually. And I had lent you a copy of Escape from New York so you could show your son.
That's right.
As the anti-hero. My question is actually Kiss Me Deadly, if you're familiar with the film, I'm sure you are, that to me is the penultimate film noir.
How would you like us to pull out a scene from Kiss Me Deadly?
It was one that I pulled out.
Play it right now.
I taught you
really?
You came up with one that I had in mind.
That's wonderful because that is the anti-hero.
So set the scene for us.
Okay, before the previous caller asked about The Killing. It was made after Asphalt Jungle. Asphalt Jungle was 1950. The Killing 6 years later when Sterling Hayden was then a star. This is early in Kiss Me Deadly. For those that are not conoscenti who really know this stuff, this is Mickey Spillane. Mickey Spillane sold more books than anybody until Stephen King. He wrote sex and violence and kill commies and things. He was a bloodluster.
And you know what the man.
He had beautifully sexy women, and they were hung up to dry and whipped, and he would always kill people. And I remember a famous one. He says, this guy can't kill me because he won't take his hand and shoot through his raincoat because it costs too much, but I'll shoot him through mine, and I'll get him first. In any event, Kiss Me Deadly is Mike Hammer, who's Mickey Spillane's alter ego. He is on a road, probably in California. He's got a nice roadster like a Porsche. He has to slam on the brakes because there's a woman who's jumped in his way, and she's terrified. He picks her up. He drops her off. He goes to his office, and his beautiful secretary, Velma, asks him, what's going on? Are you going to take this case? Are you going to follow up with what's terrorizing this woman? And he tells her what's going on. I might mention that this is late noir. It's 1955 or 6. And if you exclude Touch of Evil with Charlton Heston and Orson Welles, it's considered the closure. And the reason it ends with an atomic bomb explosion and the whole world goes up completely. This is Holocaust, so real Holocaust of the human race. That's how it ends. This, again, is our friend Mike Hammer telling Velma, exactly Velda with a D, what's going on in his case.
You ought to tell him, Mike.
Did Becker leave an address?
Oh, somewhere over on Flower Street. But if I were you, I wouldn't go.
Well, what'd you find out about the girl?
Christina Georgina Rossetti, poetess, English, born 1830, died 1894. Your Christina was being held in that hospital for interrogation.
Who by? The Feather State?
That they wouldn't tell me. What's the point of all this, if it's any of my business?
She told me if I dropped her off at the bus station, I could forget her. But if she didn't make it, she said, remember me.
Do me a favor, will you? Keep away from the windows. Somebody might blow you a kiss.
Our thanks to Josh, and let's go quickly to another caller. 312-591-7200 as Randy joins us. Good evening, sir.
Evening. I know you've been talking a lot about Robert Mitchum because he's probably the best-known actor of major stars.
If you exclude Bogart, Bogart would be even bigger, right?
Well, not for my money, but that's a different story.
Because Bogart wasn't as big and tough.
I always thought of him as just more, you know, cynical and more wise, more of a wisecracker.
Okay.
But that's personal taste. But I was wondering if Mitchum ever had any thoughts about his film noir work, because I know he was much more deeply involved in his work and really cared about it more than most people know.
Mitchum is a very complex character. He barely finished high school. He had 160 IQ, as does Warren Beatty. A brilliant guy who just drifted around, did oil rig jobs and construction work. He probably worked in a circus. He hit Hollywood with this huge chest and this huge ambition, and they start putting him to work. He said, I get paid for being lazy. I just do what I do. He became a consummate actor, but he always downplayed it. They got him to play Chandler in The Long Goodbye in the 73, and he said, I was almost asleep the whole way. So Mitchum's hard to figure out. He was always great. He memorized his lines because he was bright. He loved these roles because, as he said, I just got to act me. I got to act like a tough guy, which I was. He was so tough, Lee Marvin was afraid of him. And Lee Marvin terrorized half of Hollywood. So you're right. He's a He-Man, and I think you're right. If you take a He-Man, except for Lancaster, nobody can compare with him. Am I right?
I would agree with that. Thank you very much, Milton. You have a wonderful show, as always.
Thank you, sir, for those kind words. And let me see. We're working one more call before we pause for our last round of commercials. That caller is Vic. Good evening, Vic. You're on the air.
Oh, a couple little Chicago things. First of all, they put up a sign 6 months ago honoring the author you just saw, Bellows, on Augusta and Rockwell, Tully High School graduate, mm-hmm. by the way. And another thing is I met Mark Lawrence and John Agar together in the 70s, had dinner with them, so they were... Mark Lawrence played all the gangster movies, and Kim Novak went to Wright College for about a semester.
Right.
She lived around Diversey in Harlem, and and Jimmy Stewart, when he shot the movie Northside 77, was in Chicago, and one of the pictures is Holy Trinity Church on Division and Noble Street.
You're exactly right. It was Northside 777, three of them. And if you recall, that's when they had early faxes, and it was on a drum, and they had a newspaper, and they blew it up so they could prove that this one witness had seen the perp, who was not the perp, that he was an innocent man in Jimmy Stewart Freedom, which was based upon an actual case. You talked about Sal Bellow. I taught the One Book, One Chicago, which is The Adventures of Augie March, set around Humboldt Park, where he grew up.
Humboldt's gift over
and Kim
there.
Kim Novak is the most beautiful woman ever to come out of Chicago, if you exclude Ann Margaret, who went to Northwestern.
And I guess she's Polish and Czech, I think.
Polish as she could be, that's right. Beautiful.
Thank you.
And we thank you for those Chicago notes. And we pause for a quick round commercials. I almost said Chicago news. I wonder who they've killed in Chicago tonight. We'll be directly back after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Now, Hugh, before we go back to the phones, and we will in just a moment, or rather in 1 minute and 10 seconds, a brief excerpt from the film Force of Evil. You want to round out the selections tonight with that. Why?
John Garfield is, how could I put it, the most alienated actor of all time. He comes from the streets of Brooklyn, becomes a boxer, joins the famous group with Shelley Winters, Clifford Odets in New York, and becomes a stage actor.
Known as the Group Theater.
The Group Theater. He goes to Hollywood, and unfortunately, Warner Brothers makes him a punk crook in all the films. In this one, he's a high-class crook. He's a lawyer. He's in New York City. It comes up from the streets. He goes to his brother Leo, who runs Policy. That's the numbers racket. Before the lotto, people used to pay their insurance money, their group money, their policy money to the numbers runner. They pick in 10 cents a dollar, and as a result, all their money is going to these crooks. Leo is small time, and he's believing in honesty and all that. Joe wants to make him a lot of money. Come in with the syndicate. We're going to make it statewide, and then when it becomes a lottery, we'll have that. We'll make a fortune. He realizes, the brother, that it's bogus, it's false, he won't do it. And as a result, the mob puts pressure on Leo. Finally, Leo is killed because he doesn't go along with it. And Joe has to go down to a riverbank, and he walks down this huge embankment. It was one of the first films shot in location, to find the body of his brother. And he's regretting that he became a bad lawyer, a bad brother, and a bad human being. And again, smoke gets in your eyes. There's nothing you can do about it.
Doris was waiting for me downstairs, and we left before the police came. I wanted to find Leo, to see him once more. It was morning by then, dawn. And naturally, I was feeling very bad there, as I went down there. I just kept going down and down there. It was like going down to the bottom of the world to find my brother. I found my brother's body at the bottom there, where they had thrown it away on the rocks by the river, like an old dirty rag nobody wants. He was dead, and I felt I had killed him. I turned back to give myself up to Hall, because if a man's life can be lived so long and come out this way, like rubbish, and something was horrible and had to be ended one way or another, and I decided to help.
And this is one of the few instances in which a bad guy, a crook, who's turned in his brother and in effect become Judas or Cain and Abel, has developed a conscience, probably from the good girl he's met. And as a result, we don't know what he's going to do, but he says he's going to help. And it's sort of a bogus ending for this film because he's been nothing but greedy. And all of a sudden he's guilty about his brother. And the notion is you can have a sort of a happy ending because he's regretful, he's developed a conscience, but no good's going to come of it because he's still a crook.
Who are the great noir actors and actresses, to use that designation? We've mentioned a number of them. Who else would you put in there?
I gave you a list before. I'll go through it just off the top of my head. The femme fatales, and you have to take them because they're... Barbara Stanwyck killed more people than anybody else with a
gun.
Did
she really?
Bette Davis is second on the list. Lana Turner seduced more people. Uh-huh. Joan Crawford was vicious in almost all of hers. Gloria Graham, beautiful blonde, and she had this sort of metallic voice, and she was sexy, and she was nasal, and the big notion was she always got killed because she wasn't smart enough.
That wonderful film with Bogart. Which one was that?
In a Lonely Place.
Yeah, something like that.
In a Lonely Place, right. He's a writer. Marie Windsor was known as the woman with bedroom eyes, and she was dark, and Kim Novak's up there. Ava Gardner played a lot of seductresses. Elizabeth Scott had a smoky voice, very deep voice, and she seduced Bogart in a bunch of films. Gail Sondergaard was called the Witch Woman. She was tall, had dark hair. She later played in a lot of Sherlock Holmes films, and she was the Witch Woman in that one. Mm-hmm. Among men, the most vicious of all time was Richard Widmark. In one scene, he goes to this place to pick up some money from a guy. He's not there. His mother in a wheelchair, his grandmother's there.
I remember that scene.
And he takes the wheelchair and he pushes it down the stairs. Right. And as she goes screaming down, he just roars with laughter all the way through. He's having a great time.
Yeah.
That pretty much tagged him. Raymond Burr, before he became Perry Mason, was one of the really super heavies. He carried a gun. He was sinister. He always did bad things. Lee Marvin, one of the major. Kirk Douglas was a bad guy before he played good guys. Orson Welles is one of the great voices. George MacCready was in Gilda and others. He played the sort of German guy with the scar. He was always a villain. Richard Conti played the Italian gangster. Vincent Price was first in Edgar Allan Poe, and then he played all these heavies. He played in a lot of the Robert Mitchum films. And I'd say last, Jimmy Cagney. Cagney was great with a gun from the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, all the way to White Heat, which we actually have a film clip for. Among the macho anti-heroes, I think Bogart's at the head of the list. Burt Lancaster, a Cagney that I mentioned. Lee Marvin sometimes plays a contract killer. Edward G. Robinson at 5'4 was beating up on guys 6'5". John Garfield, Sterling Hayden, those to name a few. One more.
And Robinson, way back in an early film in the 1930s, is really playing Al Capone.
Yes, he is. Little Caesar, and he's playing all of those types as well. He is probably the original gangster that made Warner Brothers famous, and he was supplanted by Bogart, who played his second in command.
Yeah.
And then Cagney came into the picture. But Robinson was more popular than those two for many years.
We want to get back to the phones for one or two more quick calls, and next up is Tom. And you are on the air, sir. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. I haven't heard any mention except in that last reference to the female femme fatales, of the debt these detectives owe to Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes.
Did you hear our program the other night when we were talking with a biographer of Conan Doyle?
I wish I would have. Milton.
Well, it's on our website in podcast form.
I will definitely download it.
Let me address that. Film noir is at the opposite, the antipolar of Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes has a world that can be fixed. It's fractured, and the detective heals it. He patches it back together.
And ultimately, he patches it back together with the skills of rationality.
And rationality rules, and you have order in the world. That's the Greek world, in which if you get rid of harmartia and hubris, you can solve, as in Oedipus, once you get rid of him, the problem's solved. In noir, there is no salvation. There is no solution. Staying alive is heroic, and the big notion is the whole world's going to hell, as in this one, Kiss Me Deadly. The bomb is going to take us all. And the writers of these were looking at the atomic bomb as, big word, the foretelling that everything was falling apart. So when you look at Conan Doyle, we have a well-made world, Jane Austen novel, and everything can be fixed. Everything's band-aidable. Now we have cancer, and it's terminal. That's the difference.
And then one other thing I notice is that while often the police officers are also in on it, some of the detectives rely on a good cop, for lack of a better expression, to run, you know, background checks or whatever and assist them in their investigations.
Right. The good cop very often grew up in the same neighborhood with one of the criminals. It's Glenn Ford all over the place. He died. I didn't mention him before. And the good cop usually has to confront some childhood buddy, just like Spencer Tracy and Clark Gable do in several other films. One's a priest and one's a criminal. So you find that quite often. The good cop is usually brutalized. One of his family is raped or killed, and he is taking revenge. And he gets smarter once he gets angry, and he starts using his fists and his gun. You find that the good cop turns into amoral, kind of vendetta guy after a while.
Sarah, we thank you for the call. Do these films work on young people today if they get access to them, as they might get through all the new ways of seeing film, including, of course, the classic channels on...
My freshmen and sophomores love them.
Yeah, your students
They didn't love them when they couldn't get them at Blockbuster because they didn't carry them, but now everything's online. And
so you've hooked them on film.
I've hooked them on Turner Classic Films, and if you get them into one, they begin to like somebody like Bogart or somebody like Cagney, then they get into them. If you watch Turner Classic movies, they're getting a younger audience. Usually it's the parents that put them on to it. And every time I say to a student, how did you watch Force of Evil? My dad loved it, and I watched it. So it's really a generational thing.
Very last question coming very quickly, and this is Ron calling from Detroit, I gather. Good evening, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Rosenberg, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. Just the movie perhaps your guest has heard of. The title now is Hollow Triumph, but the original title was The Scar with Paul Heinrich.
Right. Heinrich was, I think, a Hungarian or a Czech. He came over because of the persecution in Europe.
He's the noble husband of Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca.
Right. He is. Yeah. And Heinrich is very famous for playing a patriot who won World War II by coming over here and telling us why we should watch out for Hitler. Uh-huh. But you're right. He's in this film. He has this scar on his cheek. It reminds me of Capone. And Heinrich was famous for either playing a patriotic Frenchman, as in Casablanca, or he played a psychiatrist who was very sympathetic, but in a very few.
He's not a Frenchman in Casablanca. He is a Czech.
That's right. He is a Czech. Yeah. Right.
Though he...
Laszlo.
Laszlo something or other,
that's
yeah.
right.
Well, that would make him a Hungarian, I would say.
What?
I don't know.
But a whole bunch of actors came over and played Nazi in German films in World War II, even because they knew the language. And it was really sad because they escaped Nazi Germany.
Our thanks to the caller. One curious connection. Werner Klemperer.
Yes.
Plays a Nazi in a television series.
And his father was famous, Otto, who was the great conductor, beautiful musician.
And his cousin, Victor Klemperer, was a Jewish resident of Leipzig.
That's right.
Who survived the Nazi years and wrote a great journal, which was published only 10 years ago or so.
That's
I reviewed
right.
it for the Trib, I think.
And Werner, of course, was in Hogan's Heroes, playing a commandant at this Stalag, camp. And using the language of the people that he hated because of this whole family history.
Another such who sometimes played a Nazi, though he was also a film director, was Otto Preminger.
Yes. Preminger is very famous. Preminger was one of those expatriates I talked about. And
He was a director, yeah.
Yeah. He and Billy Wilder were great friends. All of these people were. And I think with Preminger, you get another jaded look at Hollywood. He was one of these people that realized Europeans were on to reality, World War II, and we didn't catch up until about 1950 or something like that.
What's the greatest undiscovered film in the noir category? What's the one you want people to know about and see?
undiscovered film. My Secret Passion that everybody should watch.
Yeah.
Oh, right now it's a brand new one, V for Vendetta.
What is that?
It's based upon a graphic novel. It's based upon the Gunpowder Plot. It takes us back to that.
Oh, really?
And V is now in the 22nd century, and he's fighting a fascist government, which is controlling everything, mm-hmm. TV, everything, very much like 1984. And V decides he's going to blow up Parliament. He's going to do the job. And he has a train underground. He has a protege named Eva. And as a result, at the end, he does succeed, and everybody wears his mask. And the vendetta is to take down tyranny and give it back to the people.
I've seen that on television. It's not a brand new film.
No, it's about 5 years old now.
I stumbled upon that one.
Students
one
love it simply because, what's the word? Extremism for a good cause is not a problem.
Uh-huh. Hugh Ingrassi, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Hugh Ingrassi is professor of English at DePaul University. If you want more of this, you can register for his course in film noir. And if you want more of this program, you will be here tomorrow night when we talk with two people from The Onion, that is that great comic newspaper, and other interesting things scheduled. And, of course, right after the election night, we will have our special first team panel to discuss why the election went the way it did, whatever way that turns out to be. For right now, it's time to say goodnight. Thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial goodnight.